Yeah, thank you, Mark, for the introduction, and thank you for inviting me, and thank you for all of you for coming here and showing interest in this topic. And I guess this is the only place in the world where sort of this is the matter bit is the exotic bit in the title. So someone told me to use this because of the video, so yeah. This is part of my PhD thesis sort of that I'm working on currently under the supervision of Astrid Eichhorn, who you probably all know, and also in collaboration with other people from Heidelberg. And so to like motivate why the title, why looking at gravity and matter systems, the general idea of this talk is that matter is the quantum phenomenon that we can observe at accessible energy scales, while gravity, or quantum gravity in particular, is something that remains rather hidden at any observable scale. So the hope is that by finding a relation between the two, by finding constraints in a combined system, that you can put constraints on the quantum theory of gravity. I will just ignore this noise. okay, and let's just get started. So this is just another way of saying what I just said. Even already at the classical level, the two things are very interacting in some sense. So on the right-hand side, you see the matter bit of the theory that tells space-time how to curve, and on the left-hand side, you see the curvature bit of the theory that tells matter how to move. And so you can even like sometimes shift degrees of freedom from one to the other side, and so the two should be looked at as one general theory. And so the same thing also holds probably for a quantum theory of then degrees of freedom on the quantum gravity side under the impact of matter fluctuations, and degrees of freedom on the matter side under the impact of space-time fluctuations. And so the proposal is that we should, in the end, consider a theory of both the matter degrees of freedom in our universe and the quantum bit. And I will do so in the terms of asymptotic safety, but this general like strive for a combined theory of the two should also be regarded, I think, in all other models of quantum gravity. And so still I will first like put emphasis on the gravity side and just discuss asymptotic safety and gravity, and hope to like give to the people that haven't seen this before a small introduction, and to the others my viewpoint on the whole game, how this goes. And then I will do the other way around. I will take away a bit of gravity and look at the matter sector and asymptotic safety thereof, and then I will try to combine the two. So, but as I already said, it's the scales in fundamental physics that we hope somehow relate the two regimes. So on the one hand, it's the scales that separate the two regimes, but then it could also like pose a relation between the two. In particular, the quantum field theories that we know of, so the standard model, they describe the forces of nature as gauge theories, and in particular as renormalization group flows. So you can determine the renormalization group running of the couplings, and so the quantum fluctuations, the quantum bit of the theory, really introduces a scale dependence. So for example, here you have a plot of the strong coupling constant that you all have probably seen, and you see that going to the UV, the coupling becomes smaller and smaller, and therefore in the end becomes asymptotically free and perfectly perturbatively renormalizable. In fact, it's perturbative renormalizability that serves as a guiding principle of what not only what we observe, but also what we do not observe. So in a sense, what I mean is that you apply some principle of canonical power counting, and the operators, like in principle, you could write down all operators that obey the symmetries, in this case, the strong symmetry. And if these operators obey the symmetries, that's not enough. They also have to apply a principle to like exclude most of these operators. And that principle is perturbative renormalizability in that case. And so from all of this, what is missing? It's obviously gravity. And why can we neglect gravity? Well, because the scales are so separated, right? Because Newton's constant, so this is a dimensionless version of Newton's constant, but Newton's constant itself is incredibly small at all observable scales, and therefore only this dimensionless version will only become important once we reach like very, very high energies, which basically defines what we mean by a Planck scale. And so this is the regime where we would expect that some theory of quantum gravity becomes important. It's from just taking into account this basic argument. It means that we expect quantum gravity to be important when the Newton coupling becomes of order one. And so the task then is to find a quantized description of that spacetime. And initially, people just took the quantum field theory, the well-known perturbative tools, and applied those. And then you immediately basically find that the theory is non-renormalizable, which shows in the negative mass dimension of the coupling. And so people like Toft and Veltmann, they sort of looked at that and found that at each order in perturbation theory, you introduce new divergences to your theory. And so that's where you can give up the hope on finding a quantum field theory of gravity, or you can notice that this word of perturbative is actually not a restriction of nature, right? Nature doesn't have to be perturbative. It's just that we find the perturbative solutions first because these are easier to access. But that's a computational restriction, or somehow, if you get rid of the need to define something perturbatively, you can maybe still define it. And so the question is, can we make sense of this in a non-perturbative manner? So to wrap this up, we sort of know that general relativity or diffeomorphism invariant metric theory is a perturbatively non-renormalizable theory. And the question that I want to ask, or that asymptotic safety wants to ask, if this can still be quantized as a non-perturbative theory. And this we can do maybe by weighing the classical scaling, so I've told you about this dimension of minus two, against quantum fluctuations of the theory. So on the one hand, you have the classical dimension, and on the other hand, the quantum bit. And if you weigh the two, you can maybe introduce some quantum scale invariance, which is different from the classical scale invariance, and you will see what I mean by that. So, but in general, I think many of you spent like last week on this, trying to figure out what this means, the path integral for metric theory or for gravity. And in particular, I want to make a disclaimer here. Most of what I would have to tell is going to be in a Euclidean setting. So it's basically a theory of space and not of space-time. But the question I want to ask now is, what is this microscopic action that we should put there? This is actually what we want to find, right? So the microscopic action could be like the Einstein-Hilbert action, would be this. But in general, quantum fluctuations will introduce like all kinds of different operators as well. There's nothing that forbids writing down other symmetry invariants or other diffeomorphism invariants. So you could, in general, write down all operators allowed by symmetry. And this is also the ansatz that asymptotic safety wants to take. You just really, in principle, allow for all kinds of curvature invariants. So in principle, you allow for an infinite dimensional theory space. And then, of course, the question is how to deal with that. But let me first maybe make this point that if we had this principle of perturbative renormalizability for the strong interactions or for asymptotic freedom, so now we are really in need of a similar principle for all these infinite dimensional couplings, right? So now we need to check how far we can still apply a principle of canonical power counting in terms of when we have such a non-perturbative theory. And yes, sure.
So we will look for drift constraints between in this geometric theory space, assuming, I guess, the standard model.
Later on, I will I will search for constraints in this theory space, assuming like consistency with the standard model. Yeah.
The assumption of the standard model a restriction or?
In some sense, it's the most straightforward thing, right? Because to just take the meta degrees of freedom that we already observed. But it's not in general a restriction. You could have like heavier degrees of freedom that we have not yet observed. And this sort of then either changes the constraints that you get or loosens them, essentially, because you introduce new degrees of freedom.
So when we say something about the final theory of this form, we have, I guess, to keep in mind that this is for the standard model.
Yes. So many things that I will have to say hold under the assumption that there's no new other new degrees of meta degrees of freedom. Yes.
What about the issue of the asymptotic freedom not being engaged in because the company culture is getting weaker, so you get So that this is implying that gravity gets weaker. Big G is going to zero.
If G is going to zero, we don't know that yet.
No.
So,
but if it's not getting weaker, then this is the point. It's not obvious that when you scale big G, that it leads to a perturbative situation where things work.
Yeah, this is exactly why we are in need of a non-perturbative description, because the perturbative description seems to not work.
Non-perturbative descriptions don't work in field theory. At least we don't know how they work. Like confinement, we don't really understand confinement yet, because it's non-perturbative.
And in some sense, so I will tell what I mean by having a guiding principle in this setting up of it may be a non-perturbative way of making sense of field theories. And I agree on the fact that it's not easy to work in a non-perturbative regime. But I think you can still come up with stuff. So you will see what I mean. And maybe we can then discuss again. But so the hope is really that we find a similar guiding principle in the non-perturbative setting. And this is what I will tell now. So and this is what basically the asymptotic safety conjecture of Weinberg in the 70s is. So you have the beta functions of your theory. So basically, this tells you the scale dependence of all your couplings in the theory. And then you want that all these beta functions vanish because that is just scale independence. So this means that you have a scale invariant regime. And in particular, in this sketch of, I mean, this is not infinite dimensional because I can't draw that. But this is, of course, the scale invariant regime. Then. So it's the fixed point of the theory. And this sort of is the first demand that you have when you want to build an asymptotically safe theory. The second one, because there is a second one, is predictivity. And this is sort of where you could imagine that if something goes wrong, it goes wrong there. Because this is sort of similar to when you go to higher loop orders, you introduce new divergences. This would mean that if you introduce new directions in theory space, you have to fix them all by means of your experiments. And then you would be back in some effective field theory setting. So the second demand of a fundamental theory that is predictive is that there's a finite amount of attractive directions. And attractive directions in this plot are the blue directions, or in this sketch are the blue directions. So I really mean that if you start out from the scale invariant regime, you can find, so each trajectory here is a theory. And so all these theories are completely well-defined in this blue plane in terms of being UV complete. And so I have to make a measurement in this direction and a measurement in this direction to fix which particular theory I'm talking about. And so I do that, and then I sort of have fixed myself to this blue surface, which we call the critical hypersurface. And then the UV repulsive directions are different, because if I'm now away from the surface, even a tiny bit, then I will, like you see in this sketch, I will diverge away from the fixed point. And so these theories that are not within this surface are not completely UV complete. And therefore, this sort of idea of demanding a UV complete theory defined by this fixed point then gives you the predictions in terms of the UV repulsive directions. And this will become very important. And so, what we want is then to have finitely many and possibly, hopefully few of these attractive directions. And then we can predict stuff about the repulsive ones. So, and as I said, this theory space is in general infinite dimensional. So to calculate, most things that are calculated are done in truncations, which again reduces this to a finite dimension, of course. So for example, here it's just back to the Einstein-Hilbert. And then you apply these truncations and search for fixed points in this finite dimensional coupling space. And then you try to enlarge the coupling space. That's the name of the game. And we do that by means of functional renormalization group equations. And these, sort of to give a brief introduction to those as well. So now you have a quantity we call the scale-dependent effective action. So that's the quantum effective action made or built out of all operators and according couplings in front of them. And it's scale dependent because we have a scale dependence in the couplings. And also, I mean, these are again the dimensionless couplings. And so you have to put a dimension or a momentum to the dimension. And so this action really interpolates now between, on the one hand, if you take the cutoff to infinity, which means you haven't integrated out any degrees of freedom yet, you get back to the classical action. And this is what we want to find in asymptotic safety. That's sort of the prediction that we want to make. And on the other hand, if you take the cutoff all the way down to the infrared, you already integrated out all degrees of freedom. And finally, you arrive at the full quantum effect of action. And if you then apply the quantum equations of motion, this basically already tells you everything about your quantum theory. And of course, this is a theoretical construct and is in principle governed by the flow equation. So the flow equation tells now the scale dependence. So I just take a scale derivative here with respect to the scale k of this scale-dependent effect of action. And then it is the propagator of the full theory that is infrared regulated by this regulator and UV regulated by this insertion. And then this sort of presents a finite version of this action. And now the beauty of this is that you can now introduce truncations and project on the certain beta functions. So now you just really project on some curvature invariant or some invariant of your symmetries, and then you basically project on the beta function of the theory. And so this you do for a certain truncation. In particular, you can start with a one-dimensional truncation. So this is the one-dimensional action. So you just write down an action of the Newton's constant with the curvature there, and then you find a beta function. And that beta function has, of course, again, this dimensional bit, so the 2gn. Is the dimensional bit, and it has some quantum effect that is there. And the two now can balance out at a particular value of the coupling constant. And you see that this coupling constant is attractive, so I could have chosen any value here for the infrared value of this coupling. I would at some point be attracted into the scale invariant regime. So here you have the classical scaling, so it just grows quadratically. So this is, again, the dimensionless version of the coupling constant. And at some point, you transition into the scale invariant regime, and the dimensionless version of the coupling becomes constant, and then the dimension full Newton's constant starts running. And so if you go now to the next order, so this is just the business, then you go to the two-dimensional truncation, and you find, again, another relevant direction. So now you have the Newton's constant and the cosmological constant. And here you have a plot of the two dimensionless versions of those. And again, you see a scale invariant regime. The arrows are pointing towards the infrared. So every arrow pointing outwards is attracted into the fixed point. And therefore, I can pick any part of any point in this plane, and everything defines a well-defined theory. So I will now have to do two measurements, one of the Newton coupling, fix it very small, one of the cosmological constant, and then I have some trajectory describing my theory. So now something is right, right? We have a fixed point, and it seems to be that asymptotic safety works. But something else must be around. So now we need to find these UV repulsive directions. Because if this goes on, and we introduce new directions, and we need to fix them by experiment, we don't get anywhere, right? So then the theory is not predictive. And so let me just be a bit quicker for now. This is what we've looked at. So these are the first truncation and then the Einstein-Hilbert truncation. And then you can write down all sorts of higher curvature invariants at the curvature squared, cubed, and so on level. And I'll just quickly summarize that. So here, usually you get a further attractive direction and then a repulsive direction. And then, for example, the Gorov-Sagnotti counterterm, which introduces divergences in perturbation theory, this is another repulsive direction. And then you go on and try to, this is all a lot of work, so that's why all these different works. But in general, you go on now, and in particular, this direction is fruitful to calculate, and people have done so. And you can really go up to very high order in curvature. And so now you see two nice principles emerging. So this plot, they plot the negative critical exponents. And in particular, so you see that two of them are now UV attractive directions, while all the other ones are UV repulsive directions. And the higher you go in canonical power counting, so the higher you go in this power of curvature, the more repulsive the directions become. And so this means that if you go if you now want to predict what happens if you include r to the power of 500, you're very sure to predict that it's one of these irrelevant or one of these repulsive couplings. So this is what we mean by near-canonical scaling. And this is then the principle that might still give us and make sense of the theory in a non-perturbative manner. Yeah?
If you have R-squared theories, mm-hmm. and we normalize them.
Yes, R-squared on its own. Yeah, so I agree on the fact that, of course, if you have just an R-squared theory, there are ghosts in the theory is non-unitary. But in fact, so this is kind of, it's not a surprise, right? If you write down another curvature coupling, this will appear in the propagator and will introduce another pole in the propagator and therefore an instability. But so the hope or the idea, if you really want to test unitarity of this of the full theory space, the idea is you shouldn't do that in a truncation, right? Because if you do a truncation, you will introduce a lot of unphysical poles that just come because you truncated. So if we really want to ask questions about unitarity, we should do so in like functions of curvature or something. Yes, so the idea is that, or the hope is that if you have a whole function of the curvature, that this is then a unitary theory.
This is about string theory. String theory, you can rewrite string theory as
Yeah.
So, mm-hmm.
Yeah, exactly. So, and then a similar thing would
help. The claim is that there is not finite, provided you don't truncate.
Yeah, so the truncation, but so this is something that, so in some sense it is intuitive that truncating introduces instabilities, but of course this does not say anything about the infinite dimensional thing.
Sorry, you said that the Gorov Sinyachi term is repulsive.
Yes. So this doesn't mean that it's zero at the fixed point, right? Because it could be like it takes some particular value, but it's repulsive, and this means that it doesn't introduce a new need for fixing a parameter. Just like all of these curvature to the power of n couplings do as well.
I mean, you probably would have to introduce it in the fixed point.
You what? Sorry.
You probably would have to introduce a term like that at the fixed point.
Yeah. So in general, we sort of expect that all these terms are around at the fixed point and take non-zero values because of symmetry adjust. And the second thing that you, and this sort of is related to your question, everything of that is around. So why doesn't it mess up what we had before? And this is the second thing that you can sort of see in this plot. You see apparent convergence. So you see that, especially in the UV attractive directions, you see here that if you introduce these new parameters, they just wiggle a bit, but sort of they converge to more and more to a particular value. And so, I mean, sort of the f of r direction is the most straightforward direction. And so, I mean, of course, the community tries in part to expand this sort of in all directions in theory space and come up with such plots in all directions. But so to summarize, I think that this is at least some kind of evidence for asymptotic safety in pure gravity. And so this is a good moment to pose further questions if you have further, because I will then move to asymptotic safety in matter. Yeah?
This is a simple-minded question. The standard explanation as to why gravity is not perturbative in normalizing is because G is dimensional, has dimensions.
Mm-hmm.
So this is well known. So what happens to the dimensional constant G? You convert it into dimensionless constant. Am I getting it?
So yes, I converted. So I'm looking at the dimensionless constant. I'm looking at the dimensionless couplings, because these would appear in some scattering cross section. But
Yes.
That's why it's perturbatively renormalized. Yes.
So.
Yeah, in some sense, we wanna ask what happens when we go to the non-perturbative regime. This is sort of what. So I'm not claiming that this is the only thing that could happen. It could also happen that the theory is also non-perturbatively non-renormalizable. But sort of this is what this idea tries to explore.
Okay.
Okay, so but now let me get to the matter bit. And you're fully right in saying that all the couplings of the standard model, all the interaction couplings, are dimensionless couplings, right? So they are lacking, or they are not having this canonical dimension bit. So in four dimensions, that's zero. And that's why it's perfectly, or that's why it's so perturbative. And this is also why it's not that easy to have asymptotic safety now, right? Because we had asymptotic safety in gravity because you had a classical bit and a quantum bit, and you weighed those against each other. And in the standard model, it seems that this classical bit is not there. So you must have some kind of two different kinds of quantum fluctuations to get asymptotic safety. But before talking about asymptotic safety, so this is sort of my view on the standard model, and it could be, so in particular, as the quartic Higgs coupling is measured, there's in principle no reason to believe that the standard model is extended up to the Planck scale, right? So there's no need, no intrinsic need up to the Planck scale for new degrees of freedom. But there is, so if we now interpolate further and ignore gravity, which we probably should not do, then we see that there are inconsistencies in the standard model. In particular, there are perturbative Landau poles, and possibly this also indicates non-perturbatively. So there's also studies on the non-perturbative triviality problem in the hypercharged sector. So for the U1 coupling, this is this one here. So the other gauge couplings become asymptotically free, but the U1 sort of diverges at some point. And the same thing happens in the Higgs-Yukawa sector later on, but it also happens. And therefore, this poses inconsistencies. So what do I mean by inconsistencies? I will tell now, but the principle is now that we can hope that quantum gravity has something to say about that regime. And so this is sort of the other side of the picture. There's also inconsistencies in the standard model, and we can hope that quantum gravity can sort of help us with them. So, but asymptotic freedom is nice because it poses a way of really taking the cutoff to infinity and extending the theory to a fundamental theory. And that's what we like about asymptotic freedom. So it comes with this crucial minus sign here. And then you have an anti-screening effect of the quantum fluctuations. And the couplings are driven to smaller and smaller values in the UV. And if you take the cutoff to infinity, the theory is perfectly fine. And so what's bad about asymptotic safety is that it doesn't predict that coupling, right? So I can take, from here on in the UV, I can emerge to any value of the coupling. We don't know that arbiter a priori. So for example, in QCD, it's lambda QCD that we have to measure. We have to measure the scale that is basically introduced by this coupling. And so the other way that happens in the standard model is, for example, for the U1 hypercharge. There you have the difference sign here. And then you have screening quantum fluctuations. So it's just the opposite. Now the coupling grows towards the UV and falls towards the infrared. Now the coupling is, in fact, predicted by taking the cutoff to infinity. Because if you take the cutoff to infinity and you want to avoid these triviality or these poles, and this is exactly what triviality is, then you have to put the coupling smaller and smaller. And finally, the coupling will be zero on all observable scales. Therefore, there is a prediction of the standard model if you take it as a fundamental theory for these types of couplings, but we don't like the prediction. It's zero, right? So that's why we say that the standard model must be an effective field theory and that something is missing. And now, so asymptotic safety lives on the boundary of the two, right? So now we could imagine that there is some anti-screening gravity contribution and some screening matter contribution, and then you weigh the two against each other. Just like we weighed the classical against the quantum contributions for gravity, now you have two quantum contributions. One may be coming from gravity and being anti-screening, and one being screening from the standard model. And so then if you have a coupling value in the UV, which is very high, then the screening fluctuations will dominate because just then the cubed coupling is just larger, and they will pull the coupling down towards this what we call the fixed point value. And if you have anti-screening, it's domination, it's the other way around. If you have a very small coupling, this term is irrelevant, and then this one dominates and it pulls the coupling up. And so then you have here at this particular value, which is the prediction of asymptotic safety, a balance of screening and anti-screening. And so in some sense, having an asymptotically safe coupling in the standard model would give us the possibility of having both a UV-complete theory with a finite coupling. And that's why sort of in the standard model, it's very interesting to look at asymptotic safety. And gravity is one way of introducing another quantum fluctuation that sort of gives you this asymptotically safe regime. And so now we can ask the question, what happens if we put the two sides of the theory together and we add matter to gravity or gravity to matter? And so before going back to the standard model, let me talk about the interaction structure of matter and gravity in general. So there's a mechanism that goes by the name of gravitational induction that basically just tells you if you introduce matter degrees of freedom to a theory of quantum gravity. So I just put fermions here, and it's quantum gravity because I have a measure term here that guarantees diffeomorphism invariance. And so if I expand this part of the action in terms of curvature curvature fluctuations, then and also of matter fluctuations, then I have two matter fluctuations, so two legs in these vertices, and then I have an arbitrary amount of curvature fluctuations because I can this introduces arbitrary amounts of curvature fluctuations. The same holds for other bits of matter. And so I will always have this thing. When I have kinetic terms, I will have vertices with two matter legs and an infinite amount of graviton legs. And then, of course, I can build diagrams with that. So these diagrams will be present. And if the Newton's constant or gravity is non-vanishing or non-negligible, these diagrams will not be zero. And therefore, they will induce these couplings. And so we sort of asked what's the reason behind this, and the reason is global symmetry. So it's the global symmetry of these kinetic terms that causes certain couplings to be present once gravity is present. This means that the theory in the ultraviolet must be very, so once gravity is around, the meta theory must be very interacting on also with each other. So each form of matter via gravity interacts with everything else. That's not too surprising. And so it's terms like these here, and they are intuitively built from like taking kinetic terms, because these have the symmetry of the kinetic terms, and then just contracting the indices in all possible manners. Yes?
You can't have conforming variance if you have any mass terms. There is no matter. There's no mass. Mm-hmm. M squared, phi squared.
But so first of all, scale invariance and conformal invariance are not necessarily exactly the same, right? Because I have the additional conformal symmetry. And then, so what do you mean by the question?
Conformal gravity.
Yes.
Masses.
You can't have the graviton mass.
Well, any mass. As soon as you put a mass in, you put in a scale, a dimensional scale, you violate conformal symmetry.
Yes, you're right. So you would think that at the fixed point where the theory is really not conformal but scale invariant, at the fixed point, these things should vanish, right? But the mass term is specifically a term that breaks the symmetry, that breaks these global symmetries, right? So in this case, it's exactly. So you wouldn't expect that the mass term is induced. It's only these higher dimensional terms. And then also, these terms are all of if you look at the coupling and its canonical dimension, it's always a negative canonical dimension. So these will always be, canonically irrelevant couplings. And so this induction, we find that this causes for a weak gravity bound. And so how does that go? If you take such a coupling, so this is this chi coupling, this complicated coupling that I've written down, you have a canonical dimension bit. I said it's irrelevant. That's why you have this 4. It has canonical dimension -4. And then it has a pure meta contribution that's just quadratic. So it's some kind of parabola beta function. And it has a vanishing fixed point. So it has a fixed point at vanishing coupling chi equals 0. And this changes if you now have gravity around, because you have diagrams that go with the Newton constant squared, but not with this meta coupling chi. So once gravity is there, it shifts this curve upwards, because this is just a shift, and therefore this vanishing fixed point moves to finite values of the coupling. And so essentially, this is what is why we say induced, because then the fixed point has a non-vanishing value. So you can't have an asymptotically safe regime for quantum gravity without necessarily also having a non-vanishing value in these couplings. And then you can already see that if you make gravity stronger and stronger, so if gravity would be stronger and stronger, there's a critical value of gravity in which, at least in this truncation, the beta function seems to go above the zero line, and then there's no zero left, right? Because so if this is even stronger, then there's no zero left, and no zero left means no fixed point left. And so it seems that if you have too strong gravity, this triggers new divergences in the matter sector of the theory. And so this is why we call this a weak gravity bound. And sort of we started investigating this along different, because you could imagine that this is just an artifact of this truncation, and if you like separate the couplings in some better manner and do better projections or look at other bits of the theory, then you would get rid of that. And this is actually not the case. So you can, for example, expand the gravity truncation. You can now also introduce a cosmological constant. And also, you can do the same thing, I just don't plot it here, with higher curvature couplings. It's all in this paper. And so, but the cosmological constant now, if it's large and negative, it works like an effective mass. So, and in particular, this is the microscopic cosmological constant. So this is really, it's the fluctuating bit of the theory. And so now, if you have, if this is zero, you're back to this case, where if you increase the strength of gravity, you at some point run into the bound. But then if you're at very negative values, the bound is much later. And so it really seems that what I want to emphasize here is that it's not just the Newton's constant that determines the strength of gravity. It's really the full theory space. It's the effective strength of the propagating modes of gravity. And therefore, this poses not a restriction on the Newton's constant, but a restriction on the general theory space. It sort of cuts out a regime in which gravity acts very strongly on the matter content, because then I couldn't couple these matter degrees of freedom. And so the remaining question is, if you add matter to gravity, does it weaken or does it strengthen gravity? Because if it strengthens gravity, there's sort of some kind of back coupling reaction, right? If you add more matter, it strengthens gravity. And then it puts you in this above this bound. And then at some point, there would be a restriction on the matter content that you could have in a quantum theory of gravity. OK. And so this is still a bit of an open question, but we hope to have a definite answer at some point. And so having this, let me move back to the standard model degrees of freedom. So now, let me first talk about the gauge couplings of the standard model. And I've basically already told you the mechanism, so this maybe is a good time to repeat this. So now you have the screening fluctuations, and they are composed of the gauge fluctuations themselves and the degrees of freedom that we already have observed. We put this in this NC, and then there could be other degrees of freedom around. That's the question that you posed before. So if there are other degrees of freedom around, this sort of changes this factor. And also might change the fact if it's screening or non-screening. And then there's the gravity bit that we need to calculate. And there's been a lot of calculations, in particular with regard to gauge theories. And one thing they all have in common, so quantitatively they vary, but they all have in common that they have a negative overall contribution. So they have an anti-screening contribution. And if this contribution is anti-screening and this is screening, you can have a real fixed point. And this is the fixed point that governs predictions. So it's really whenever you have this situation of screening and anti-screening that you have a fixed point. And then you have this thing that I sketched already. Now you have it in a real plot. You sort of, if you come from very high energies, you're pulled towards the fixed point value, either from very high coupling value by the matter fluctuations or from low coupling values by the gravity fluctuations. But these two regimes are still different, right? Because here, this is really a regime that is not extendable to a fundamental quantum field theory, because you have, again, divergences at finite scales. Here, you're just in a different regime of the theory. Now you're pulled towards asymptotic freedom, and so the theory sort of becomes asymptotically free. So in some sense, this fixed point value of the non-Gaussian fixed point poses a predictive theory when I choose this non-Gaussian fixed point as defining my theory, and it poses an upper bound on the theory when I pose the other, when I choose the other fixed point. And so now, applying this to more concrete models, we can first ask what happens if we go to the standard model. And if we go to the standard model and we look at the strong interactions are not screening, so this is not this case, they are anti-screening. And then you have two anti-screening contributions, so gravity just works as speeding up asymptotic freedom. So you would just get a glitch in this curve and go quicker to zero. But this is different for the abelian gauge coupling. For the abelian gauge coupling, it's the other way around. So then you really have a screening contribution. Assuming that this is anti-screening, you now get this picture where you have a predictive trajectory that goes to asymptotic safety. It goes to a finite value in the UV and evolves to some value and also works as an upper bound on the other coupling values that you could have that then run to asymptotic freedom in the UV. Or if you're above the upper bound, the theory is still not fundamental theory. Yeah?
Is there an easy way to see that quantum gravity contribution is always anti-screening?
So,
I don't know.
No, as far as I know, it's not really an easy way to see that. But already, if you just calculate the contributions of the transverse traceless mode, this is already just an anti-screening effect. So I can't give you an easy argument, I guess.
Yeah.
Yes?
The line of gravitational wave detection involved in black holes.
Yes.
Actually, it's highly non-interpretive. Highly strong gravity. So the question is, can you have
mm-hmm. So,
with this,
you mean that I either violate the gravity bound that I had before, or I violate the possibility of crashing these two objects. So it really then depends on what you view as, so what you expect the theory actually. What you expect from a quantum theory describing a black hole, right? A black hole in general is still perfectly well defined in the classical theory. So it's really the interior of the black hole that might at some point become quantum.
Neutron stars banging together, strong gravity.
Yes, yeah, so you could expect that maybe at some point in these mergers, you somehow get effects from inside of these objects that sort of percolate outside. And for example, all these higher curvature invariants that are present at the fixed point, if there are still some reminiscent at these energy scales of these higher curvature invariants, they will change the waveform of the gravitational wave. So you can, yeah, so it depends on how much they are restricted. So this is not really a moment that we and also all other quantum gravity models should check for predictions of these operators. And then you can like give these two waveform catalog people and match them to observations. And this is just another idea how to exclude quantum gravity models. But I agree, it's a very interesting time for that. Okay, but so this also now works in a setting in case this sort of for the standard model it doesn't work, it can maybe still work in grand unified theory. So in general, this is not restricted to what degrees of freedom are around. So you can now, and in particular, that's why this other N here is introduced, you can have the breaking scalars of some grand unified theory. So if you need to break down the SO10 that has then a 50 here, and then you introduce a lot of matter fields, so you change this N, and at some point, it just means that you now have a relation between your gauge coupling constant, in particular, if you take the breaking schemes, your electromagnetic gauge coupling constant, so the fine structure constant, you relate that to both the meta content of your theory and the quantum gravity contribution. So in the end, this just gives you one relation of these things. And then you can, like, in principle, it fixes the value of these gauge couplings in terms of quantum gravity, which we are not really sure about, and the meta content of the theory that you have around. And so a similar mechanism also works for the other. So this works for every coupling in the standard model that has itself a Landau pole at some point that is screening. And then if you have an anti-screening, so it's really, if you have an anti-screening gravity contribution, then this mechanism works. And so it at least puts a bound on quantum gravity being viable in this model. And if it fulfills this bound, it makes a prediction. So how does it work for the Yukawa coupling? So if you have a Yukawa coupling around, then that's the same thing. You have this screening contribution. You have a rising beta function. So now this is another view on this. You have a rising beta function that just has one fixed point. And gravity is a linear contribution now. So it will shift this beta function. So and whether it shifts it upwards or downwards changes if you can cure this triviality problem. Because in the this again just gives you this triviality problem that I've already explained. And the fundamental theory has a vanishing Yukawa coupling and therefore a vanishing top mass. And so now gravity will either be screening as well. Then you see this black curve here that sort of just shifts. It just increases the rising of this beta function. And therefore, the fixed point remains UV repulsive. So this regime doesn't help, right? So then the coupling is still trivial. And so it's really the sign of this gravity contribution that changes between the two regimes. So if it's then anti-screening, you get this balancing effect again, and you get this interacting fixed point, and you get the similar picture for the Yukawa coupling as well. You get this predictive trajectory, and all the trajectories below the predictive trajectory are still fundamental, and the ones above are non-fundamental. So you get a free fixed point, that's this one here, or in terms of the running, it's the free fixed point here that accommodates for all the Yukawa couplings or masses below this predictive trajectory. And you get the non-Gaussian fixed point. If you demand that you're at the interacting fixed point, you then get a prediction for the coupling. Then it's precisely this one value. And so the interesting question is, of course, what is this value? Or what is this value roughly? And in particular, this now puts another constraint on your quantum theory of gravity, because if this complicated function that you can derive, and in principle it's a function of all the curvature couplings, if this function is positive, it doesn't work, and if it's negative, it works. Therefore, it puts like a cut in your theory space again. So here you have this weak gravity bound, where we had already argued that there's no fixed point at all. And then you have us enter a second regime where there is a fixed point, but the fixed point doesn't fulfill this demand of this being an anti-screening thing. So you have vanishing Yukawa couplings and therefore vanishing masses in your running. So that is also bad for a different reason. And then you would need to go to some more exotic matter theory if you want to make sense of the theory to make it experimentally viable. And then there's this final regime where you can have viable infrared dynamics without new degrees of freedom. And so it's really that now there's this idea ties the meta degrees of freedom to your quantum degrees of freedom, at quantum gravity degrees of freedom. And so it is that the observation of matter at accessible energy scales can put constraints on gravitational dynamics at Trans-Planckian scales. That's really the main message, basically, of the whole talk. And so then, of course, the interesting question is, what does this green regime exactly look like? Right. So what masses do we predict? And this is the answer to it. So this plot now shows you that you have, once you cross here is again this bound. So here would be the yellow region and finally the red region. And if you enter this green region, you sort of have a wide space of regions where you predict a top mass that's rather in the regime of the standard model. So this is sort of because the running towards the infrared is also dominated by running fixed points or running partial fixed points. And therefore, a lot of trajectories are pulled to the standard model value. So in some sense, the UV value is a bit washed out. And therefore, this regime is so broad and the prediction is so, in general, matching this. And of course, now the question is, what's the actual prediction of truncations? So, and if you take particular truncations, these will determine the fixed point values of the Newton constant and the cosmological constant, and in particular, here's a simplified form of a truncation where you have already included, or the authors, Astrid, Pietro, and Roberto, they have included already minimally coupled matter degrees of freedom. So now you have Weyl fermions here, and scalars, and vector fields. And the interesting bit I want to point out here is that if you add Weyl fermions and you add more of them, you flip the sign up here, and you do not yet flip the sign down here. So adding Weyl fermions kind of puts you in a regime where you go to negative microscopic cosmological constant, and at some point also to larger values. And this then leads to, I said that it works like basically an effective mass and suppresses gravity, and this is exactly what it does. Then it gives you the fermionic matter content of the standard model could really put you in a regime that is with negative cosmological constant and therefore in this viable regime. And this is the mechanism that actually also really takes place. So if you take the standard model, you take 45 Weyl fermions, so a lot of fermions, and you take scalars and gauge fields, and then you arrive at these fixed point values, you plug them in, and you're somewhere in this region. And the exact value is, of course, now subject to a lot of truncation issues, right? You have higher order curvature couplings that could like change that. But so in general, leaving this broad regime, you would really need a far distance. You would really have to change the fixed point values enormously in the truncation. So the one bit that it really relies on is the contribution of matter to the gravitational fixed point. Yeah?
It's possible that there's nothing above the top mass. It's called the desert. There are no particles above the top mass.
Yeah.
Obviously, it's not seen
near
up to 2 TeV. So what happens if that is the case? Desert between the top.
Yeah, so if sort of this desert would not be around, and we would measure like a particle at very heavy, so we would measure a fourth generation of fermions or something like that.
All of that would be gone.
Then this sort of would exclude definitely, or somehow definitely, this particular model. Because you this is stating that you could not have much heavier fermions around. And then you would need to change your model, basically. Okay. And so, I mean, this is all work in truncations, but it ends up, you can then really have a dynamical changing of the two regimes. So these are really now the beta functions of this truncation, and you really evolve now the Newton's constant and the cosmological constant, and they transition around the Planck scale, which is, of course, set by demanding that the Newton's constant takes these incredibly small values in the infrared. And then it transitions at precisely the Planck scale. And then the matter theory transitions into a different regime. The gauge couplings become free. The top coupling takes this asymptotically safe fixed point value. And you can do these general plots, which are, I think, very nice. Okay. And do I have like... Yeah, I have like 5 minutes left. So let me give you an outlook on what we're currently working on. This is combining the two things, because you could argue that you want to have like the most asymptotically safe model now, right? So every coupling that you can make asymptotically safe, you want to make asymptotically safe, because then you can predict it. And so I haven't yet asked the question of making the gauge sector asymptotically safe and the Yukawa sector asymptotically safe. And there's a very interesting reason for why we should look at that. And that's if you take now two different Yukawa couplings. So you take the top and the bottom, then without the gauge fluctuations, so if the gauge fluctuations become asymptotically free, these terms are gone, then the two beta functions look exactly the same. So there's nothing that changes between the two couplings. You can exchange the top for the bottom, and therefore there's no reason to expect that the couplings have any hierarchy. But this changes if you have gauge fluctuations, because then the couplings have different hypercharges, right? So then the beta functions look different for the two couplings. And therefore, in principle, you can now hope that if you introduce these charges, then that the charges discriminate between the two couplings. And if you have an asymptotically safe U1 coupling, you could think that this, at some point, must establish a difference between the two masses, between the two Yukawa couplings. And in particular, you can solve these three equations, so these two and the gauge equation and the gauge coupling equation. So remember, the gauge coupling was also asymptotically safe. So I'm now really working in this regime where the gauge coupling and the two Yukawa couplings all become asymptotically safe. And then you can solve this fixed point, the fixed point equations for a fixed point relation. This is just because you have one contribution that's the same for the two Yukawa couplings from general, from quantum gravity. And so then you solve this equation and you find that if you demand that the bottom is much smaller than the top, so this equation is basically zero for the bottom, then you must be in some regime in which the top coupling at the fixed point is roughly a third of the gauge coupling. So this would give us a hierarchy. And then you can look at the standard model. And this is really surprising to me. So we now really fix these quantum gravity contributions. And note that we made, I just make very general assumptions now at that point. I make the assumptions that the quantum gravity contribution is the same for the Yukawa couplings, that it's the same for all gauge couplings. I make the contribution that it arises at the Planck scale. I make that assumption. And I make the assumption that it works linear and anti-screening. And then you can like plug in the values of the standard model. You plug in the regime here for the gauge coupling, and you plug in a regime for the top mass, and you run, and in particular, you run specifically to a value that's very close to this one third. So what does this mean? Does it mean anything? Well, it could mean that the gravitating standard model also predicts you some mass differences. And so to put this in another plot, here you have now this relation translated into the microscopic gravitational coupling G and the microscopic gravitational coupling lambda. And so you can again draw these curves of a viable gauge coupling value, a viable top coupling value, and a viable bottom coupling value. And notice that the curves of the bottom and the top are shifted. They are shifted because the gauge coupling has different contributions. And then these three regimes sort of meet. So it seems that there is a relation between the different charges of the standard model quarks and their masses. And so in particular, if you change the charges, so if you, for example, take them to be equal with opposite sign, so they are 1/2 and 1/2, then this doesn't work anymore. So then you pull apart these, so then basically the top and the bottom are treated the same, and if they have different masses, then it doesn't work. And if you put larger charge separation, so you put 5/6 and -1/6, it also doesn't work. So once you change the charges, this mechanism is gone. And so with this sort of interesting little bit, I'll leave you with my conclusions. So to conclude, there is the possibility that you can draw conclusions between, if you have a metagravity system, you can draw conclusions between the electroweak scale and the Planck scale, and therefore you can pose constraints on quantum gravity by the matter content. In particular, you have seen this weak gravity bound, and that there's different regimes in which the theory is phenomenologically viable or not. And then if the theory is phenomenologically viable, it might UV complete the standard model. And if it UV completes the standard model, it might do so with a higher predictive theory than the standard model. So you've seen that it could predict the gauge coupling or some of the Yukawa couplings. And so in general, this is subject to the convergence of fixed point values in gravity. And these need to be studies in the future. So the numbers should be really cautiously taken, but the structure is the important bit. And I think there's a lot of interesting structure that we can see from this. And with this, I'd like to thank you for your attention. Yeah. There are not too many questions.
There's another approach where you use infinite derivatives, type of vertices, mm-hmm. So delta function. Then quantum gravity can become finite. still recolonizable. Not perturbative, because it's a finer recolonization.
Mm-hmm. So I don't know if
this approach. That's another possibility.
And, but you only have a finite amount of additional curvature invariance. So how does it exactly work? I haven't.
It looks all finite.
Oh, okay. Okay. Yeah, maybe there's some relation of that to asymptote.
Maybe a relation.
Yeah, maybe.
So this is probably just my confusion, but usually for my understanding is that for particle physics, you can use the Euclidean regime because you have some, when you have mm-hmm. a fixed background structure, you
yeah.
know that you can rotate back and find. But here you're doing that for gravity itself.
You're right. This becomes much more sort of unsure if you can rotate or not, because you're changing the background structure. You're changing the metric as well. And in particular, in all of these calculations, to make sense of the of this Wilsonian integration of momentum shells,
right.
you have to introduce a reference, sort of, because you need to make sense on what is a large momentum and what is a small momentum. So you introduce a background metric. And at some point, you need to get rid of this background invariance, this background dependence, so because the theory should not depend on the background that you choose. And this is a subtle issue that sort of is discussed within the community.
But I agree that you have this difficulty, but you would have an added difficulty of making sense of, if you want to relate this to Lorentzian
mm-hmm.
gravity, you have an added difficulty of having to define that.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. There's some studies that sort of start to look at ADM decomposition of variables and asymptotic safety in these things. So there's a 2011 paper by Frank Sauer-Essig and collaborators that looks at that. But sort of these are sort of first attempts to go towards a Lorentzian setting. But these are kind of encouraging. So this is also an Einstein-Hilbert truncation. So that's just basically the minimal truncation that you can do. But it seems that it looks rather similar to the... So the fixed point structure is not lost.
Can I ask another second question? So it seems to me that for a lot of the, as you add more terms in the truncation,
mm-hmm.
Some of the values stabilize, basically, of the fixed points of previous
yeah.
elements of the truncation, right? So you can already tell that the form of this fixed point, more or less, up to some truncation, you already know what the
we have some expectations, I would say.
And do you have anything to say about that theory? And that also related to the question of unitarity. Well, it's true that you don't know if truncation breaks unitarity. Can't you have some statement that the breaking is always pushed to
Mm-hmm. Yeah, note that there, first of all, there's a difference between saying that these couplings are not around in the UV, so we expect that all the higher curvature couplings will be non-zero in the UV.
Right.
And this is important for unitarity, right? If you want to...
Sure.
And so somehow this is unrelated to the question of convergence. So the couplings could converge perfectly, but then take very non-vanishing values. And so somehow, I don't think that this is telling you much about if the theory is unitary or not.
Truncated curvature terms. I'm sure you're guaranteed to violate unitarity.
Yeah, I agree. So once you truncate them, you definitely violate unitarity. And the question is, if you do not do so, is the theory unitary? But that's a very complicated...
string theory, you don't truncate.
Yeah.
It's a finite theory. So when you talk to string theorists, you say, it's the only way to quantize gravity. I don't like string theory myself. The fact is... That's
But why should it be the only way of quantizing gravity?
You're a string theorist.
that's not convincing me. Well, I'm not a string theorist.
This is a social problem.
Okay. No, in the first part of my question, this theory that you, if you have all these coupling constants more or less
mm-hmm.
stabilized, does that tell you anything about...
So one thing that it tells you, if we believe this sort of near-canonical scaling, it tells you that all the higher-order couplings, although they might be present in the UV, they are all they are not then all UV-repulsive directions, which means that once you flowing down from the UV, once you reach the Planck scale, afterwards they will be very quickly suppressed because they are still, I mean, after you switch off the gravity regime, they still scale with their canonical scaling. Then they will be quickly suppressed, and so somehow this is what washes out observations of like R squared couplings at infrared values. Or so this is also what sort of is might be a problem in these in when looking at black hole mergers and the signatures there.
So what does the theory tell you about regimes when we expect quantum gravity to be relevant, like black hole singularity or cosmological singularities?
Mm-hmm. So there's the question of how it modifies basically your space-time in these extreme conditions, because you would expect that really in at the singularity you should have quantum gravity around. And so there's some studies that show that singularity is lifted, but this is sort of, I would say, still a matter of active research. So to improve the sort of, so there's renormalization group improved equations of these black hole equation solutions, and they try to make sense of that.
So you can modify Einstein equations?
Sorry, modified what?
You get modified Einstein equations, or
you get modified solutions of the Einstein equations. Yeah. But of course, in general, you should solve it as a full theory. So, I mean, these are only modifications, and they don't calculate the back reaction to the background. And so, in general, we would need to have like the fully quantum effect of action, and then find the equivalent of Einstein equations, then find the equivalent of a black hole solution, and then in the interior. But this is, of course, like a very long-term goal.
All right, let's thank Aaron again.